Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. This week we're going to be taking a look at James Cameron's sequel to The Terminator, Terminator 2 Judgment Day. Before we talk about the movie, I want to do some housekeeping, as I like to call it. I guess I should really call it feedback, because it's where I give a shout out to all the great feedback that I've gotten so far. I'm going to start with a Facebook post that I got from a guy named Matt Hurt. Matt says, quote, "Hey, I stumbled upon the podcast the other day and I'm really enjoying it. Your 2001 episode is one of the best analysis of the movie I've ever heard. I was listening to it on my way to work and it made me want to turn around, go home and watch the movie. Really great stuff. Also, your Interstellar episode hits on all the problems I had with the movie perfectly, though I disagree about Man's arc. I wasn't a fan of it. I'm really excited to dig into more of the podcast. Just want to share that, and thank you very much, Matt. Matt actually is doing a couple of really cool podcasts right now. He's part of a multi-person team that does the Obsessive Viewer podcast at www.ovpodcast.com. And he just struck out on his own, and he's doing a one-man survey of the Twilight Zone. The podcast is actually called Anthology. I guess he's going to do anthology sci-fi shows starting with the Twilight Zone. But it's a great show. I think he's up to episode 2 now, if you want to catch it. You can find it on iTunes, and you can go to anthologypod.libsyn.com. Libsyn is L-I-B-S-Y-N.com, if you want to check out the webpage. So lots of good shout-outs to Matt. He's doing a great job. And thank you, Matt, for the comment. There was a comment from someone who actually commented on the website, but I think he came across my link on a subreddit called LV426, which is a subreddit of Reddit for Alien fans. If you're interested, go on, check it out. His name is Chris Langdown, and he said, quote, "Hi there, I saw your post on LV426 subreddit. I enjoyed the show and thought your style was very laid back and easy to listen to. I'll definitely check out some of your other episodes. Totally agree with your point about the chestburster scene at the start. To this day, I feel it has a weird effect on the pacing and suspense. I remember seeing Alien for the first time in the early 90s when I was far too young. The loose face hugger scene scared the hell out of me and gave me a phobia of things under my bed for many years. Ha ha." End quote. Thank you, Chris, for the kind words. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you're listening. And man, that's young to see. You know, I saw Alien. I didn't catch it when it was in the theaters, Aliens. And caught it on video when I was in my 20s. But man, I can't imagine seeing that as any kind of a youth. Would be pretty intense. So again, thanks again to Chris. Also from the Reddit subreddit LV426, a user named Alaskan Skunk Bear, quote, "Fantastic stuff. In an era of vapid films and vapid commentary, your podcast is an insightful treat every time," end quote. Very nice. Very kind words, Alaskan Skunk Bear. Thank you very much. Hope I continue to live up to such awesome praise. And a shout out to my man Curtis Hayes, who threw a comment down on Facebook. Quote, "Really liked the review. By the way, James Remar was Ajax in Walter Hill's The Warriors and Dexter Morgan's father in the TV series Dexter. Also, he was in Sex and the City as someone's lover," end quote. Thanks for the kind word, Curtis. And I'd forgotten about James Remar being in The Warriors. Totally remember it now, but I totally forgotten about it. I also remember him as Dexter Morgan's father. Very brief scenes in the first and maybe the second season. When Dexter would flash back. But yes, thanks for the shout out and thanks for the info. Let's talk a little bit about the background for T2. The talk of a sequel arose immediately after it was released. I guess it did very well. The original Terminator. Cameron immediately realized there were going to be technical limitations regarding CGI because he wanted to do the liquid metal T-1000. If you remember, in my podcast on the Terminator, I talked about how he was initially going to do the main Terminator versus the T-1000 on the first film, but he realized that effects weren't up to snuff and he'd never get the T-1000 on screen looking anything like, you know, something cool. So he changed the script. He went on to do Aliens, and then he went on to do The Abyss. And I think when he did The Abyss, if anyone remembers The Abyss, took place mostly underwater. There's a scene where the alien is able to control water and make it behave in any shape it wants. And there's a great scene where there's a water tendril that comes into the undersea ship that they're on and turns into a face and all this kind of stuff. And so I guess once he did that, he realized it wasn't too far of a step between that and the T-1000. There were also these intellectual property disputes between Helmdahl, which owned the franchise rights to Terminator, and Kurilko. Given that Helmdahl had financial problems, Arnold, in his usual type A way, he urged his friend Mario Casar, head of Kurilko Films, to bid for the rights for Terminator from Helmdahl. And Kurilko paid Helmdahl $5 million for the franchise in 1990, which is just amazing to think about what a pittance they paid for it. So they resolved it. So the returning cast, obviously Arnold and Linda Hamilton, but also the actor who played the psychiatrist, Silberman, was back. Now, this is very interesting. The T-1000, who wound up being played by Robert Patrick, originally Cameron wanted Billy Idol to play the T-1000, but Idol got into a motorcycle accident and he was unable to take the role. And so then he wanted, and not everyone will know this character, but metal fans out there will, Blackie Lawless from Wasp. Was tapped to play the T-1000. But at some point, he's a tall dude. I think for whatever reason, his height made it a no-go. Something about like really super tall people don't become actors or screen actors. I have no idea why. There must be some little optical or ratio kind of thing to the lead character or whatever. But so he was out. So then they went with Robert Patrick. And they went with, you know, a non-bulky actor because Cameron's original idea for the Terminator was to be, you know, the actor or the, playing the role, and the way that Skynet would create Terminators would be for them to fit in, to be unnoticed in human population. You know, you don't create an Arnold Terminator because they stand out. You know, they're these big hulking things. But Arnold won him over when he met with him, so he changed the idea. But he went back to it for the T-1000. So you have what he called the T-800 was the tank, and the T-1000 was the Porsche. Robert Patrick, I didn't know this, he was originally, before this, in Die Hard 2, so he must have been maybe one of the bad guys' team. I never knew that. And Edward Furlong, new to the film, had no formal acting experience at all. And Joe Morton was signed on to play Miles Bennett Dyson. So briefly, Cameron and William Wisher, who also both worked on the original Terminator script, completed the screenplay on May 10th, 1990. And by July 15th, they got the first shooting draft to distribute it to cast and crew, so they really banged this one out. And so that's sort of the background that I have. Let's jump into the production itself. So we open up this great soundtrack cue by Brad Fidel, who once again did the music, to, in my mind, mixed effect. Some of it's wonderful, some of it's still kind of wonky like the first film. But we're seeing modern-day Los Angeles, we're looking at a freeway, and this is wonderful staccato string hits, very, very somber, very dour, very much in keeping from the first film. And then the white flash comes along the screen, and we flash to that same freeway area, but it's in 2029, and the freeway itself has been destroyed, and there are rusted hulks and cars everywhere. And we get a voiceover from Linda Hamilton as Sarah Connor, quote, 3 billion human lives ended on August 29th, 1997. The survivors of the nuclear fire called the war Judgment Day. They lived only to face a new nightmare, the war against the machines. And the camera's been moving the whole time as she's been speaking, and it finally ends up on a human skull that is then crushed by this metal foot, and we pan up, and it is a T-800 Terminator, with not a Model 101. I think Model 101 had skin, but a T-800 nonetheless. And we're very much similar to the first film now. There's an opening battle between hunter-killers and human soldiers. The effects are definitely a bit better. It looks like there's more money up on the screen. We hear now Sarah Connor also narrating and setting up the plot of the film that Skynet didn't send just one Terminator back. They sent two. The second one was to strike at John when he was a child, and a lone protector. And this is very clever of the film. A lone protector was sent. You know, she doesn't say that two Terminators were sent. So, you know, when we just start this film, if we haven't seen any trailers, which is impossible, right? But we don't know who's who, which I think is pretty clever. And obviously, it's set up who's going to reach him first, which is the opening, you know, dramatic import of the movie. Already, before we even start with any kind of action, we're in the first film. You know, very somber, very dour, very intense. Nuclear holocaust, machines. The music is very somber. You know, you think you're like, okay, we're continuing, because the tone of the first Terminator was relentlessly intense and serious. You know, at times, it could be accused of being bordering on a little bit overheated, but I didn't mind it at all. I really took it for what it was. You know, Cameron making a very earnestly serious science fiction thriller. However, that's all about to change. We start, like the first film, there's a deserted truck stop. What's cool is this time we actually see the black sphere emerge, where last time we kind of saw lightning and then we just saw, you know, Arnold and Michael Biehn, because he didn't have the effects to do what they wanted to do. But so we see this sphere form out of nothing. What's cool here is there's a great detail that it forms right by the corner of the back of a rig. So this is sort of an old truck stop where they store the rigs, the back of the rigs. When the sphere disappears, we see the back of the rig has been sort of eliminated exactly to the shape of the sphere, which I think is just a really cool detail. You know, he had the technical know-how this time to make it a little cooler, and he definitely did, so it was very neat. This old Arnie is back. There's also a depression in the blacktop this time, which is really cool. So you're getting the bottom of the sphere is in the blacktop. The side of the sphere is in the, you know, just made it much more real. However, now we're going to enter into a brand new movie, which we have not seen before. So Arnold walks into the bar, and we begin a sort of pop culture awareness that the film now has of itself and of its importance on the landscape. Cameron decided for part of this film to play games with his own concept. We walk in and we're seeing through the red Terminator point of view. He's sizing up potential body shapes for clothes that will fit him, right? He's naked. We see girls looking up and down, and when they reach his crotch, obviously their eyes bulge, you know. So, ha-ha. Suddenly the Terminator's funny. So he walks in and walks up to a bunch of bikers. You know, the whole scene, I need your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle. And they laugh. There's a big fight, which is pretty intense. You know, he roughs up the guy, but doesn't kill anybody, which is, again, different from the first film where he kills the three kids. And he winds up getting himself clothes. And then it gets very funny when he walks out of the bar, Bad to the Bone starts playing. He gets on the bike. You know, the bar owner comes out. He's going to shoot Arnie, but of course Arnie walks up, snatches the repeating shotgun, which he will use, then reaches into his hand, puts on the sunglasses, and it's a fight. It's a whole different story. We're in a whole different movie here. Terminator's funny, he's cool, he's a biker, you know, it's just, I don't know, it took me by surprise. Even the first time I saw it, it works, of course it works, right? But it's different. It's definitely different from what we got the first time around. The emergence of the second Terminator is more in keeping with, you know, the somber vein of the film. We have, again, where the Terminator is connected to the police infrastructure, which was very much in the first film, and which is terrific as a story driver, because, you know, I'm sure half the problems that Cameron was facing was like, how does the Terminator find Sarah Connor? How does the Terminator find out, you know, where everyone's going when the chase is on? And it's like, you know, light bulb, make him a cop, and he'll hear about it on the radio. So they kept to it this way, which is very clever. This one little detail is the chain link fence has vanished in the shape of a sphere. So that's where this time bubble occurred, which is kind of cool. We immediately see the T-1000. We don't see how he kills the cop, which is kind of cool. We just see he kills the cop and then gets into the cruiser, and from the police cruiser, he gets the Sarah, you know, John Connor information, which is very clever, you know, very easy story right here. And we're back to our, you know, original tone as well. Now we're cutting to where John lives with his step-parents. Everyone's kind of a dick in this scene. The step-parents are kind of dickish. John's kind of a dick as well. The stepmom is played by the same actress who played Vasquez in Aliens, FYI, a little detail there. You know, this starts up, there's a weird part of young John Connor being kind of a dick in certain parts of the movie that I don't know if Cameron deliberately did it that way or it was more Edward Furlong, but in this one, definitely, you know, he's revving up his bike to cut off his step-parents, you know, yelling at him. And just, I don't know, from my mind, you're not painting the step-parents as being bad people yet, and yet John's kind of just being a douche. And so you're just like, wow, who's this dickish kid? So now we get to the serious part of the movie, and we have Sarah's reintroduction, which is amazing. I mean, Linda Hamilton transformed herself. Just amazing what she did. She trained with a former Israeli commando and a personal trainer for 3 hours a day 6 days a week for 13 weeks before filming. She did weights, she learned judo, she did military training, and she had to maintain this really intensely demanding non-fat diet even during filming, so she didn't put on weight, because this filmed for a while. There were a lot of delays for various reasons, so filming of this movie went on for a bit. And they actually had to dub in some of Edward Furlong's lines, or actually change the tonality of some of them, because his voices had pitched differently by the end of the last scenes he was shooting. Kind of interesting. And actually, because of this regimen that she undergone, she didn't want to do it for T3, which she declined. I guess originally they had a role for her on T3. She decided not to do it. And we meet Silberman again, played by the same actor, who is the shrink in the police station in the first Terminator. Actually, I think his name is Earl Boehm. He's been in a ton of stuff. So here's a very clever way of introducing people who haven't seen maybe the first Terminator, which was kind of a genre B movie. He's walking with a tour group in the facility, and he's recounting her story. And it's such a clever way to introduce all kinds of things and to get exposition out without before you really realize it. First of all, they're moving, and you keep cutting back into Sarah's cell. You see her just so incredibly cut. I mean, it's unbelievable. But so it's great. So he's describing to everyone about, you know, the Terminator back in time. She thinks this, and he's doing it in a humorous way. But, you know, people haven't seen the first film and now getting the info. It's really great. And we haven't seen her face yet. We just see here. We start seeing her doing pull-ups on a bed she's flipped up. So she's doing pull-ups on the leg of a bed she's flipped up on its side. And her, she's got this V cut that, like, you know, man or woman, you give your eye teeth for. I mean, she just looks amazing. She's in this wife beater. And finally, Silberman arrives at her door. She turns around, and her hair's over her face, and she just looks like this caged animal, man. I mean, she is amazing. Her physical presence and performance in this movie is not to be denied. We cut away briefly back to John's step-parents, and we see the T-1000 arrive, asking about John. They give him a photograph. And then there's this weird line, which I never kind of understood, where the step-parents say to the T-1000, like, hey, there was a big guy on a bike here looking for him, too. And then there's this weird pause, and the T-1000 says, I wouldn't worry about him. And I think to myself, if Skynet sent back the T-800-101 to kill Sarah and the T-1000 to kill John, how would the T-1000 know that there was a Terminator that had been reprogrammed by Connor to protect John? So it was a weird little gaffe in the movie. Like, I see why Cameron did it, and it's clever because you immediately, you know, their knowledge of each other in a way. Although we don't know if the T-101 knows there's a second Terminator. I think, actually, it makes sense that the T-101 would know about the T-1000 because Connor wouldn't have sent it back to protect himself unless he knew that Skynet had sent back the T-1000. But so it's weird. It's a weird little gaffe. So we see John robbing an ATM, and this is a setup for some technology that he has created, which will become in later use. It's a ATM pin card cracker. And again, I'm not really, you know, I have to say, I refer along to most of this film. I really don't like the character. I really don't like the actor. There's a couple of scenes where I think he does a good job, but it really shows. You know, he's talking about, he's telling his friend, you know, about his mother, and we get some information that Tara had tried to blow up some kind of facility, and I would imagine that it was, you know, something she thought was part of a burgeoning Skynet, or something where she thought the chip and the hand were stored. I don't think she knew about the chip, but I think she knew about the arm. But so it landed her in this what's called Tuscadero State Prison. I don't know if it's a real place, but so we kind of get a little bit of backstory. But him telling his friend is just, he's not a good actor, you know. So I'm not sure what Cameron's MO was for Connor's casting. Then we cut back to the prison, the hospital, and this is Linda Hamilton's moment in this film. Her and Silberman are watching an old videotape of her. She's like she's trying to talk him into giving her parole, going to minimum security so she can break out and, you know, go find John. They're watching a videotape of her talking about her nightmares, and she's talking about how she, you know, the nightmare, which we'll see later on, is really about a nuclear explosion and people being burned alive and blown apart. And she's really intense here, man. Really, really amazing. And we think we're watching her at first, and then we cut away and we see that her and Silberman are watching the tape. And it brings the film back. There is a side of T2 that's bringing forward the intensity of the original Terminator. It's balanced. Well, I don't know if it's balanced. I don't know that I'm such a fan of it. By young John Connor and Arnie. There's a lot of comedy between the two of them, which kind of, maybe Cameron thought that it was just too dour, it was too heavy. And he might have been right, you know, I can't imagine it. An R-rated, big-budget movie that was all doom and gloom that would have sold a lot of money, and, you know, back in 1991. Now, she's trying to bullshit him by telling him, no, I don't believe that's true anymore. Obviously, it's a delusion. There's a great setup for a cut here. And she's like, so you no longer think the company covered it up? She's like, well, why would they? Then we cut to Cyberdyne Systems. We see this massive, you know, computer team at work on some kind of chip. And we do a walk and talk with Miles Dyson and this little programmer geek who's walking with him. The setup is you have to sign it out, which is, I think, is really cool. You know, the intern's asking him, you know, do you know where it came from? And Dyson's saying, you know what they told me when they gave it to me? Don't ask. So we obviously know that Dyson's not covering anything up. He doesn't know anything either. And they do this nuclear, you know, nuclear-like two-man key security system. And they walk into this vault. And we take out a chip, which to the, you know, the casual viewer doesn't mean much. But then the camera pans back and we see the arm of the 1984 Terminator in a glass cabinet. And it's just great, you know, that's boom, there it is. Very cool scene and wonderful cross cut to Sarah saying, why would the company cover it up? And then, of course, we cut right back now to her and Silberman denies her. She loses it and leaps over the desk and chokes him, tries to kill him. He winds up looking into the two-way glass and model citizen. So now we get the build up to the two Terminators getting to John. The initial Terminator had been to the step-parents' house, so he's been cased in the neighborhood. And I can believe it that he sees now John on his motorbike riding with his buddy towards the mall. He spies him, turns in pursuit, and the T-1000 has been casing the joint, but with the photograph asking kids. He asks this one girl, who I didn't know was a young Nikki Cox, if there are any Nikki Cox fans out there, who knows him and says, yeah, it's the Galleria. Yeah, he said he was going to the Galleria. Some other scuttlebutt is that that's actually Kate Brewster, who he will wind up being with because he supposedly went to school with. And in T3, they'll talk about, you know, that kiss that they had right before he went to the mall. So we think that this is Catherine Brewster, although I don't even, you know, Cameron obviously had no notion that that's where it was going to go, but they kind of retconned it a bit. Look, you know, right now, what's kind of cool is you don't know which is which. The only clue you have is that the Arnold Terminator doesn't kill anybody, and the other Slender Terminator actually, you know, killed the cop. So we don't actually know that he killed the cop as well. He kind of, you know, he what we think is punched the cop in the stomach. Later on, we recognize that he turned his arm into a knife, killed the cop. But, you know, if we're patterning on the first film, we think that Robert Patrick is the good guy and Arnie is the bad guy. So it's really clever, and he hasn't made the switch yet. And it's wonderful. In the game room, Connor's playing Missile Commands. That's the game he's playing, which I think is a great little tongue-in-cheek. You know, will he protect the world via Judgment Day? So kind of funny. And then the hallway scene between the two Terminators, which I think is great. And the suspense is incredible because you still don't know who's who. And John's right in the middle, and you see, you know, Arnold's carrying this box of roses. There's some a little trivia about, you know, they're playing a Guns N' Roses song when John's on his way to the mall. Arnold is carrying a shotgun and a box of roses, Guns N' Roses, haha. He sees the original Terminator. He turns and sees the T-1000. He doesn't know which way to go. And then, you know, get down, Arnold. So obviously now we see the wonderful, the first barrage of bullets. There's this flowering on the T-1000's chest. Every time a bullet hits it, you know, it's as if it's made out of liquid. It's like a splash that solidifies and then kind of goes back to its original shape. It's really cool. And then it reforms. Then there's this great thing where the T-1000 opens up and shreds the T-800's back. And Arnie, you know, knocks open a door and throws Connor into it. And then the two grab each other and they're smashing through concrete walls. There's a real deadly earnestness here because neither of them are talking. You know, in any kind of Hollywood action movie, if you're having a fight where the villain's not cackling and sneering and the, you know, the hero's not saying, I'm going to kill you or whatever, it, to me, it just makes it more of an earnest battle. It's terrific. And, you know, as they're throwing each other into these cinder block walls, the walls are caving in. It's really amazing. And for a moment, the T-1000 gets the upper hand and Arnold is thrown through a plate glass window. And we see very small detail, but important for what will come a little bit later, is a guy snapping pictures with like a fast shoot lens. And you can see the cameras pointed toward Arnie. But of course, he gets up and heads right back in. And so we're right onto a chase scene. I mean, half this movie is a chase scene, which I'm not a huge fan of chase scenes. So, you know, there you have it. The only cool standout to me in this chase scene, or two cool things, is that they jump the huge 18-wheeler cab from, if anyone lives in Los Angeles or knows about Los Angeles, they have the Los Angeles River, which is a, you know, sort of a weird artificial valley that's carved through lots of the surrounding areas of LA and fills to the brim with overspill when it rains, but a lot of the time is empty. So the chase is on this riverbed, which is clever, you know, the LA River, but it's down a level. So we see in one scene the cab of the rig jump completely and land, which is a neat little stunt. And then there's another stunt when the T-800 finds the two of them being chased, where the bike actually does the same jump. And what I found out is that, because it looks like, I mean, when you watch the film, you can kind of tell it's not Arnold running the bike, first of all. But it's not so high that you think maybe it wasn't a stunt and maybe it wasn't real. It looked completely real that this bike really did that jump. But I found out later it was supported by 1-inch cables so that when the bike hits the ground, you know, and I guess with that much of a weight, if the bike jumped that far, it would just completely spin out of control. So the wires made it seem as if the bike only weighed 180 pounds when it hit the ground. And they digitally erased the wires later. So very cool, because I never knew that. I just found that out doing research for this podcast. And, of course, we get the early moments of Arnold's use of the repeating shotgun, which is that really cool gun he used. It's a sawed-off shotgun, and you reload it by spinning it around your fingers, which took Arnie a long time to use. He shredded his hand learning how to do it. Actually, not as easy as it looks, but he mastered it pretty well. And he winds up, you know, hitting the gas tank and blowing up the cab of the rig. So they escape, but in the fireball, now we see the silver sort of globule slowly reforming into the shape of a man. And so, you know, we get a sense of what it is. There's a moment, too, where he's battling in the mall where the T-1000 walks by a silver mannequin and just he pauses for a second to look at it before he keeps going. And it's sort of a foreshadowing of what the T-1000 actually looks like, which is kind of cool, too. It's a little tongue-in-cheek on Cameron's part. So now we get a little post-action exposition. We have John and the T-800 on a motorcycle. Arnie is great in this whole film, as usual. Whatever they ask of him, you know, whatever you think of what they did with the Terminator's character, he's amazing. We hear now a bit about the T-1000. What was that thing? You know, advanced prototype, a mimetic polyalloy, liquid metal, great. He wants to go home, and he says, you know, the T-800 says no. The T-1000's first job would be to go back there to impersonate your parents. What happens to them? They're usually terminated. So they do this great scene where he calls home. You know, we cut to the house and we see the stepmother there. Like, John, we're worried sick. What's going on? You know, where are you? And to me, there's a little bit of a flaw here, which he must have really did some hardcore editing. But that he says, something's wrong. She's never this nice. But we've never seen her be mean. Actually, we've never seen the step-parents be mean. There's this one scene where we see the, you know, the husband kind of on Saturday watching TV, and he, you know, the wife's kind of nagging him, but we don't get the sense that the dicks are mean to the kid. When he's like, oh, she's never this nice, there's a moment which I just like, I don't quite get it. But anyway, first, then when we get this weird kind of cross-cutting, because we get the T-800 asks, he takes over the conversation and he says, what's the dog's name? And I think he says Spot or something. And so in John's voice, the Terminator says, you know, Janelle, what's wrong? Wolfie's barking. Then we cut back and we see Todd, the husband, is like yelling at the dog for barking. And she shifts the phone to another ear and we see an arm reach out of the frame and we don't see what happens to anything. And all of a sudden, Todd stops talking. But then we hear the T-800 say, you know, what's wrong with Wolfie? Why is he barking? And she's like, Wolfie's fine, honey. Wolfie's fine. Where are you? He hangs up the phone, tells John, your foster parents are dead. Very clever. Very clever. And then we cut back to the foster parents and we pan to the side, follow her arm as it morphs into a giant steak knife. And we see Todd. It's gross. I mean, the poor guy didn't deserve this in the film, but impaled through the mouth, through the back of the head, to the wall. And also there's a carton of milk that's also impaled that's spilling. It's just gross. Just, you know, whenever you get these funny goofy scenes between the Terminator and John, you think you're in a PG-13 movie, and then you get these scenes and you're like, oh shit, we're in an R-rated movie. It's such a strange combination, this movie. Weird how it balances things. Then the plot quickens a bit here where we cut back to the hospital and Sarah's sitting with Silberman and some bunch of detectives who have come in and showed her. And this is a great story point. You know, they show her a picture which we can tell was taken from the police station back in the original Terminator. Bit of a detail side note is that they didn't actually have that shot. So they had to recreate that hallway and recreate Arnie a bit. Supposedly, if you look really closely, you can tell that it's Arnie's, because Arnie slimmed down a bit for this. He's not as kind of puffy as he was in the first film. He's a little more angular with his muscles. and his face too. But that they actually had to recreate that hallway and that shot to take the photograph of it because Cameron didn't have what he wanted. So very interesting. But so they throw the first shot down, and then they throw a shot down of Arnold. And the cop says, this guy was spotted at a mall in Reseda today. Sarah finds out that her son is missing, the foster parents are dead, and she just goes dead. She just completely goes for what everyone thinks is comatose, because she knows, you know, it's great, as we know as viewers, it's like she's got to get out of this hospital. So great scene, great scene. Just at the end of the scene, we close up really tight on her hand, and she grabs a paperclip, which, you know, if someone takes a paperclip in a movie, it's not for keeping paper together, I'll tell you that. So now we're with John and the Terminator, and they're in some back, again, I think of Los Angeles, how much this was filmed in L.A. L.A. has these little side streets. For every main street in L.A., there's sort of like a parallel side street that runs behind the businesses. And so they're sitting in one of these streets by a dumpster, and the Terminator is just standing there, and John's telling us about his time with his mom and that they went to Latin America. And he's kind of okay in the scene. He's very whiny in a lot of this stuff, and he's very unlettered in so many things. And this one scene, he gets okay because he's just being very honest about, you know, what they used to do and that she was just trying to learn from anyone who could teach her about explosives and weapons and military tactics. And there's this moment where, you know, he goes, everyone thought she was nuts, even me, but she knew and nobody believed her, you know. And it's a touching little moment, you know, that she's stuck in this prison. And then he wants to go get her, and the Terminator says, you know, no, that's the, you know, the T-1000 would definitely seek to kill your mother and copy her. There's no way we're going there. So they get into this thing where the Terminator picks him up, and he finds out one way or the other that the Terminator has to obey his commands. And then they do this goofy thing where he makes the Terminator stand on one foot. He had been yelling earlier when the Terminator picked him up, and these two guys come over. And this is kind of a douchey part of this movie. These two guys come over to help him. By the time they get over there, he realizes that the Terminator is his to control. And so they say, hey, kid, you okay? And he's like, you know, fuck off, douchebag. And the guys are like, we came over here to try to help you. And the kid's like, you little douchebag or something. And so he orders the Terminator to, like, hit them or beat them up. You know, the Terminator beats one of them up, and then he's about to shoot the second guy. John jumps in the way, and the guys just run off. It's just tonally very weird. I always thought it was very weird. He's a whiny little dick, you know. He's got his, and this is the beginning of what I like to call the other side of this movie. You know, one side of it is a continuation of a very earnest and deadly Terminator film, and the other side is A Boy and His Robot, which is where this starts, the standing on one foot kind of crap. And I just never buy it for the rest of the movie. I mean, it works, and I can see how populist it made this film, and now the Hasta La Vista, and everyone loved it. And if you didn't want to buy into the intensity and the seriousness of the film, you got to ride along with, you know, John and his pet robot, and that was all fun and games. But I don't really like Furlong. It's kind of like the Jake Lloyd syndrome for me. Like, I don't even know how bad the role is, because I just feel like the actor playing it, like, yes, you know, the Anakin Skywalker character in the first, you know, Phantom Menace is pretty execrable, but Jake Lloyd is so terrible that you don't even know if it actually could have become something, if someone who played it with any modicum of talent would have made something out of it. But same here. That's sort of like with Furlong. I don't know. Because to me, Furlong's going through most of this movie like it's not a big deal. Like he hasn't been traumatized by his early life. He's like, he's having fun and teaching the Terminator tricks to do and all this crap. And I don't know. I don't buy it. It's just like some kid with who's weightless as a character. Just kind of odd, you know? So now we get we cut back to the more serious aspect of this film, which is Sarah escaping the prison hospital, which is terrific. And it starts out with this creepy moment where the main guard tucking her in, you know, he's putting all these straps on her. He licks her face. He sticks his tongue out and licks her face and expects her to react, and she doesn't, and so he leaves. And man, her escape here, her physicality in this whole escape is so fucking good. I was sold on her when I saw her, but now, by the time we get to the end of this sequence, man, this is some badass commando who you do not want to mess with. And no weapons, too, which I love. I mean, no gun. So it's not like, you know, that will come later. But, you know, hand to hand, she's just dynamite. So she spits the paperclip out. And I guess Linda Hamilton had taken some lessons from locksmiths on how to actually do this. So, you know, using the paperclip to get out of her shackles. And she does everything with a wonderful economy. Ties her hair back. The paperclip's in her mouth. Then she breaks it in half and does the lock in the door, which is really cool. Then we cut point of view, and we're with the creepy security guard as he looks in a storage locker and he sees a broom. The handle's been broken off. And as he backs out, now we see Sarah burst out of her room and she strikes him these four brutal strikes, like a couple of times in the face, the back of the head, the back of the knee, the elbow, like just very precise, brutal strikes. And we see this blood come out of his face. You know, he's down. She takes the keys and bundles him up and kind of drags him to another room very, very efficiently, and then exchanges her broken off bit of mop handle for his baton. Right? So she's actually got kind of an upgraded weapon, which is just so neat. And then she starts jogging forward in the hallway towards, you know, her next moment. It's kind of military jog, and she's just amazing. Her body, the shape she's in, and her deadly earnestness, like, it's incredible. And then she surprises Silberman and another orderly who are standing by an open door. And she does it by throwing the keys she's carrying at the orderly, who, without realizing it, is distracted and goes to catch the keys. And she has that moment to then beat the crap out of him with the baton that she's carrying, which is amazing. And then Silberman tries to make a phone call. She blasts him on the wrist, on the arm, and then another strike on the knee and takes him down. Again, more incredible surgical strikes. And then grabs a huge syringe, and then great shot. She takes some cleaning fluid and puts it down right in front of the camera, blasts the syringe into the plastic and you know, withdraws it full of cleaning fluid. And we close in on Silberman. He's like, what are you going to do? The whole thing was done with just such an incredible economy. And her performance was just incredible. I mean, every ounce of training she went through before the film so came through in this particular sequence. A lot of other sequences as well, but amazing. At the same time, now we have this wonderful rising tension because the second Terminator has arrived at this hospital to get her. And because he's a cop, he easily gets through the main gate. But there's this great sequence where he kills a security guard. So the T-1000 becomes the floor for a while, masquerades as the linoleum floor. The guard walks over it. As he's getting coffee, it sort of materializes behind him as an exact duplicate of him, which is really great. There's a moment where they're just staring at each other, and then the Terminator extends one finger. It goes right through the corner of the guard's eye and out the back of his head. Just gross. And again, there's a moment while he's just there, shuddering, and the coffee falls on the ground and spills, you know, back in our movie territory, you know? Really gruesome. And then we're back where, on the way to the hospital, you know, he tells the Terminator he can't kill anyone. And they have this really goofy dialogue. You just can't kill anyone. And the Terminator is correctly asking why. Because you just can't. He's just a whiny little bitch for a long. And then he makes him swear not to kill anyone, raise up his arm and say, I swear I will not kill anyone. And again, we're in this goofy tone that's in half of this movie. Now we cut back to inside the hospital, and there's a standoff, which is really cool. She brings Silberman up to the door with this syringe kind of already put in his neck, but she just hasn't depressed the plunger yet. So she manipulates him into opening the door and getting by them. And at one point, there's an orderly behind her who pulls the syringe away from Silberman's neck. So now she's on the run. And then we see John and the Terminator enter the facility. He shoots the knees out of the cop and opens the door. And he's like, what did you do? And the Terminator's like, he'll live. So, you know, haha, that's funny. So then there's this great moment where she runs for the elevator. And she's made it, basically, you know, if she can get past the guard outside. The Terminator walks out first. And she sees it, and she just loses it. And it's a perfect moment because, you know, from her perspective, she knows it's in this time period. She knows it's after John. There it is. So she loses it and turns around and runs. And runs back into the arms of all the orderlies and Silberman, who are waiting for her. And Cameron does this great thing, is that they're all focused on her. John comes out after the Terminator, like, Mom! Of course, a little too late. But no one else sees the Terminator until it actually is right there and starts pulling the tormentors off of her, throws them and knocks them all out, and she gets up. And then all of a sudden, now the T-1000 makes its entrance, and there's that great scene of it walking through the bars of that it's been behind. And there's this great moment, you know, Silberman has obviously been not believing any of what she has said the whole time. And of course, he's had this plastic tip in his mouth that he took because he was about to inject her with some drugs that will calm her down. And when he sees the T-1000, the cap just drops from his mouth. It's a perfect little detail. And she's been completely vindicated in his eyes right at that moment. And then there's the great sequence where they get in the elevator, but the T-1000 gets to the elevator, and then the two arms separate and open it up. And there's a shotgun blast to the head, which cleaves it into these two halves, which is just so creepy and wonderfully done. And it wavers a little bit. And they're able to close the door and get away. And now we're in for another chase scene, which for me, you know, the only cool thing about this brief chase is that as soon as Sarah's in the midst of it, she grabs a gun out of the Terminator's belt and starts firing at the T-1000 on the roof. And man, again, Hamilton here, you know, she's asking John for reloads, and we realize that they've been through this drill before. She tried to teach him all this stuff. There's, I think, a little production note that she, at one point during shooting this scene, she forgot to put her earplugs in and suffered a little bit of permanent hearing loss because of shooting a gun and that's in that small space. She kind of damaged her hearing. So now we start with the part of this film where it's the Terminator begins to act more and more human, and Sarah becomes more and more Terminator-ish, which I think is a really clever through line of this film, you know, is her development and where she's been and where she goes. Her immediate reaction to him is, you know, you're too important. Why did you risk yourself by coming to get me? And, you know, he actually Furlong has a nice moment here where he says, I had to get you out of that place. And she doesn't, you know, she's like, you made a huge mistake. Don't ever do it again. Now we're in, you know, at some point they find this empty garage, the service station, and they hole up for the night. You know, basically John is talking to the Terminator and she's just brutal and cold and sitting there eating, you know, staring into space, just completely, you know, having lived in this hospital and her whole life being extremely single-minded, you know, she's become incredibly shut down in every other way. It's really interesting. They cut a scene here. There's a scene in the extended edition where, you know, in the theatrical version, the Terminator tells John that the more it interacts with human beings, the more it learns. And so you're good to go with him learning things. But in the extended version, they have to actually flip a switch in his CPU. And there's this moment where they shut him down and they open up his brain case and they pull out the CPU. And Sarah and John have this argument whether or not to, you know, smash the chip. And she's about to smash it. And it's not a really good scene, actually. It's not well acted. And it was right to be cut, I think, from the theatrical version. But just interesting that in that scene, they had to take the chip out to flip a switch, put it back for him to start learning, but not to be in the theatrical version. In the morning, they leave, and there's more of the My Pet Robot theme, as I like to call it. Terminator breaks the glass in the door, and John flips down the visor on the passenger side and dangles the keys in front of the Terminator, saying, are we learning yet? You know, ha-ha. So on the way, they're driving. It's the whole Hasta la Vista. You know, why do you have to be such a dork all the time? It's just, I don't know. It's the My Robot thing again. They stop for gas, and there's this great moment where there's a couple of young kids running around with toy guns pointing it at each other. It could have been a great scene. John turns to the Terminator and says, we're not going to make it, are we? And the Terminator responds, it's in your nature to destroy yourselves, which is pretty dark, you know? But it's ruined by the next line where John says, major drag, huh? I don't know why Cameron put in the character that would, you know, keep maybe 12-year-old boys and girls from getting bored in an R-rated movie. It's just, it's so bizarre. I still can't understand it. There's another cool moment where Sarah queries the Terminator about how Skynet gets built, and he knows everything, and we hear about a guy named Miles Bennett Dyson, who we've met before, and we hear all about now. And this, you know, we heard this in passing from Reese in the first film, but now we hear that his processor and the company, you know, acquired by the military, and all military decisions become computer-controlled, and the minute that happens, Skynet learns at a geometric rate. It's very cool. So they go to this great camp. It's near, I don't know if it's in Mexico or near Mexico. They don't say, but it's all this rusted out cars and this a family there, a Mexican family there, or Hispanic family, I should say. And it's her weapons cache. You know, it's kind of great. John takes the Terminator to on weapons detail, as he calls it. And we see all these incredible weapons that she's stockpiled. Like, it's unbelievable. And it's a funny line, and Mom sure knows how to plan ahead. And she transforms and changes out of her hospital garb into khakis and fatigues, and she's, you know, just really looks so incredibly tough in this baseball cap and these sunglasses. Really neat. And we get more of a John's backstory about him growing up in places just like that. And they have this moment where he's changing the Terminator's changing the starter motor on the truck, and John's helping. And then it's just an odd little moment where the Terminator asks John, why do you cry? They keep it sort of real where the criminal pain causes it, you know. So the Terminator's learning, obviously. It's a strange scene. I don't know that I dislike it, but it's just, you know, more a boy and his pet robot story. Especially when he starts the thing and then he teaches the Terminator how to do high fives. It's like, okay, you know, I guess it's funny. And Sarah watches them and her dead delivery, her voiceover, you know, kind of punctuates the theme here that of all the fathers that have come and gone in her life, that this machine is the only one who lived up to. It would never hurt him, never beat him, never get drunk, never tell him he was unworthy. It would just protect him in his perfect, unbroken way. So it's a really interesting notion the camera was playing with here, which is why these movies are great, because Cameron's a really smart guy, and although sometimes they can be goofy, he's playing with interesting ideas most of the time. So very cool. So then we get Sarah's full-on nuclear dream, which is really amazing. You know, it's this great dream where she's walking in her fatigues up to a playground filled with children. She's separated between them by a chain-link fence. There's a version of her looking like she did in the first Terminator, and I think she's in her, like, diner uniform where she was working. And then there's this impact flare in the main city of Los Angeles and this mushroom cloud. And then the present-day Sarah Connor just bursts into flames and starts screaming. And then the blast wave hits, and it blows apart all of the children and her, the other version of her, which had become, you know, ash, these sort of ash statues. And the blast wave blows them apart. I mean, and her flesh blows off. That's the burning Sarah Connor's flesh blows off. And the dream ends with her screaming and this skeleton holding onto the chain-link fence. It's amazing, you know, and it's a really incredible dream. It's so bizarre how it comes in this film. There's that, and there's the, you know, young John Connor teaching the Terminator how to do high fives. Like, it's a very weird movie in that way. But it's great motivation for her when she wakes up that she changes plans, and all of a sudden she's gone, and, you know, it takes John sitting there. She had whittled out the words, no fate, on the table, and she and John realizes that she's gone to kill Miles Dyson. And now this is her transformation is complete at this point. We get this great assault on the Dyson house. You know, Cameron, again, he starts with the first shot is Dyson's young son running along with this remote control truck. And, you know, and that's going to lead us into the action in the scene. It's very clever. We keep cutting back and forth towards Miles at the computer, Sarah setting herself somewhere in the distance. The laser pointer settling on his neck, the sun coming close, and finally, as she pulls the trigger, Dyson's son's remote control vehicle hits him in the leg, and he bends down to pick it up, and the bullet goes into the computer instead of his head, which saves his life. Just a great setup and suspense. And man, she's out of control. I mean, she busts in, and just he runs, and she shoots him, I think, in the leg or the shoulder. And then she's right there with his son jumps in front of him. Please don't kill my daddy. she's calling the mom a bitch. Like, get on the floor, bitch. You know, get the kid in the other room. But it's great. Like, when it comes finally down to it, she's about to do it, you know, and they're all waiting. And it's a really tense scene. And she finally backs off and starts crying, drops the weapon. And, you know, and at that moment, the Terminator and John bust in and... there's this wonderful scene between them two now that she kind of breaks a little bit, you know, and she's like, you came back for me. But, you know, some of her humanity has remained and she hasn't gone over to Terminator status, as it were. And then they figure out the quickest way to kind of let Dyson know, you know, who they are is for the Terminator to just basically cut off the skin on his arm. So he does this great scene where he takes a knife and he runs a cut down to the hand and then around the wrist and just pulls off his skin like it's a glove. And we see all of a sudden in the scene is the metal arm. It's the effects are done great. It really looks, it does not look fake. Really well done. So the next big sequence now is this laboratory attack. They, you know, they convince Dyson that what they tell him about the future, and he signs on immediately to destroy everything. No one can follow his work, and so they get up. You know, they get past. I think they throw the security guard in a bathroom, but by the time they get up there, another guard has found him and tripped the silent alarm. So now there's a clock. And they can't get into the room holding the key. The second key goes with Miles's to get into getting the chip in the arm. So now we get the second time John's using his ATM pin cracker. Which we've seen it before, so, you know, it doesn't come out of nowhere, which is kind of cool. And again, you know, we see the T-1000 kind of trolling around, and as a cop, listening to the frequency, cops are all converging on the Dyson building, he knows, and at the moment, he's at the Dyson house, so, you know, they just missed him there, which is really great, and, you know, now he's on his way. So then we get, you know, like the first film, Terminator versus Cops, and as they're setting charges, you know, the Terminator says he'll go deal with the cops, and he's got this wonderful Gatling gun, this minigun that actually the same minigun that the Jesse Ventura character in Predator used. I guess it was somewhere in props department that did both films, and they used the same gun. And he opens up, he destroys every cop car surgically with the minigun. It's a great scene, but it doesn't kill any police. And there's a scan that he does afterwards where it's like human casualties equals zero. So, but at that, some cops have entered the building and they enter this floor and there's a firefight that begins and Dyson gets basically shredded. And there's this great, I love the scene where they come upon Dyson holding some kind of object above the detonator, breathing out his last breath. And he turns to the cops and he's like, I don't know how long I can hold out. And they run out of the building and he lets it go down and the whole floor blows out. It's a great, you know, 1990s, you know, end of the movie explosion scene, you know. So then the next sequence, the cops shoot all these gas cylinders. Sarah and John are sharing a gas mask, and the Terminator, you know, on the ground floor walks out of the elevator. And the cops pretty much take him apart with small arms fire, but of course they can't kill him. It's great soundtrack cue here as he slowly walks towards them. You know, it's kind of the Terminator's hero moment. Takes an amazing amount of damage, and we start to get the special effects on his face now, the makeup where it looks like the flesh is peeling back and that the metal is underneath. And he basically shoots them all in the knee, takes them all out, and then walks outside with this sort of repeater grenade launcher. You know, shoots it all outside. It takes out all the cops and incapacitated. It's very clever, you know, how this was thought through. And, you know, again, I think every once in a while, I remember how wonderfully they thought this out, how direct the Terminator is. You know, he takes the cops down, grabs their weapon, which is meant to incapacitate them, turns it on them, and then he walks out into the fog. An easy way to incapacitate the cops out there is to simply rip their masks off, which he does, grabs one of their vans, drives it in. You know, it's just very, very wonderfully direct and logical as a machine would think, you know. So then they're heading out. Before he starts up the police vehicle, the Terminator pulls down the visor and the keys flip out, which is kind of a nice little payoff moment from earlier. Ha ha. And then they're heading out, and there's this great stunt when the T-1000, which has kind of gone up the stairs with the motorcycle that it's on, realizes that they're heading out. It's this great stunt of the motorcycle jumping off of the floor, and the stuntman grabbing onto the bottom rung of the helicopter and the bike keep continuing on. Really great stunt. And I'm not a huge stunt fan, but I think it's very clever. And so again, now we have another chase. We have the helicopter, the truck that they're in. And there's this cool moment where the helicopter actually travels under the overpass. A little side note is that the crew, the union crew working the shift that day, actually walked off the set because they told Cameron that it was too dangerous of a stunt and they weren't going to be involved in it. So Cameron and one person drove in a car with the camera, and the helicopter pilot actually said, fuck it, I'll do it. And so they did it, but it was, you know, a non-union moment in the film, which is kind of interesting. So then we get Sarah back in military mode. You know, she's basically firing on the helicopter that the T-1000 is in as, you know, the Terminator is driving the truck. And there's a moment here that I never catch, and I always read about it in trivia, that at this point the T-1000 has four arms. I guess you can go back and see it. I totally forgot about it. Every time I see it, I forget, because he's using two arms to fly the helicopter and another two sprout out to, you know, shoot the repeating gun that he has and fire back at Sarah. So at some point, Sarah is hit. Arnold slams on the brakes. The helicopter slams into the truck, slams down on the ground. So the chopper's down, but the truck actually flips over. Then, like the first film, we end the main chase scene with the bad Terminator in a rig, a cab, bearing down on our heroes that are in this really goofy-looking truck that they kind of stole from this guy. But there's a great ending scene where the 800 jumps on the rig of the cab and empties his automatic rifle into the T-1000 and then reaches in and pulls the wheel over, given, you know, making the cab take an incredibly sharp turn, flipping it over. It's really cool. And the Terminator leaps free. And of course, fortuitous enough, the truck was carrying liquid nitrogen. And there's this great moment where, you know, the T-1000 arises and it tries to continue on. And as it's walking, it's freezing, and parts of it are popping out or popping off, and eventually it freezes. Parts of it come apart, and then it stops completely frozen. And then Arnold gets his one moment, hasta la vista, baby, with one bullet. He shatters the T-1000 into like a million pieces. And of course, it's our first false ending. And they've ended up very fortuitously, like the first film, ended up in a machine shop there at a smelting sort of metal factory where there's a lot of molten metal around. Nice of them to end up there. It's very funny. It made me think of like late 80s and 90s action movies where the end of the movie always ended up either in a warehouse or at like a shipyard down at the docks, you know, or some construction site or whatever, some place where, you know, the filmmakers could blow up and do lots of action sequences and not actually harm anything. It's really funny. When it shows up in modern movies now, I'm always like, oh, come on. You know, the warehouse or the shipyards, you know, it's been done, you know, so very funny that this is part of it. There's an initial chase scene where Arnie fights with the T-1000 to try to hold it off, and the T-1000 sticks it in a cog, so it can't get out. Its arm is stuck, and it's closing in. So at this point, Sarah and John separate, and Furlong here at this from now on is just annoying. He's just a whiny little baby, and he sounds like it. He's really there just to be protected at this point. There's this great moment where Sarah, you know, she tries to shoot the T-1000, and her shotgun jams. But she does put one hole in its head, and the camera swivels around behind the T-1000 to shoot through the hole to see her, which is really clever. But so the T-1000 gets her, actually impales her in the shoulder. Very creepy call to John. It's like, and it's about to kill her, but we've seen earlier that our hero T-800 has ripped its own arm off in order to continue the battle and grab this long iron bar. And right before the T-1000 is going to kill Sarah, it cleaves him in half with it. Great special effects shot as it's kind of in half. And then the T-1000 sort of re-knits with it still in the middle and then like shoots it out to the side, and now it has this weapon. They battle, and of course, you know, the T-800 is completely outmatched. And there's this scene where the T-800 gets his head just smashed in with this girder that's on a dolly. Just like four shots, and so badly damaged. And then he crawls above some kind of mesh walkway, and he's impaled with the iron bar. And we see this, you know, we see this this lightning, which is very cool, which we've seen before in Terminator films, that tells us that the Terminator is now dead. We see the eye go out as well. And so now we're thinking the T-800 is gone, and John's by himself. But we cross-cut back to the T-800, and we see from its point of view that it's actually rerouting power. It pulls the bar out from its midsection and grabs a grenade launcher with one grenade left in it. So now we get this thing that John hears himself being called by Sarah, and he comes close. And then there's this great shot where, you know, he's looking at what he thinks is his mom, and then behind the T-1000 comes the real Sarah, of course. And there's this incredible end action sequence with Sarah, which is like one of the coolest things. You know, one of her arms is kind of done. And so she's blasting at the T-1000 with this shotgun and reloading it one-handed. And she's really doing it. Like, she must have practiced this. I mean, it's really impressive. I mean, I can't imagine doing it. She does it like 6-7 times. She shoots and then flips it back, and it's not like Arnold's where you just flip it around. She actually has to jack it up one-handed to reload it, and then she brings it back to bear and shoots it, and over again. It's the most, one of the most kick-ass, you know, female action scene sequences I've ever seen, man. She's just amazing. And it's a great tension moment because she finishes emptying the shotgun, and the she's about, you know, the last shot would have put the T-1000 over the edge into the steel, but she runs out of shells at that moment. The T-1000 knits itself up. But of course, behind her now, riding some wheel, comes Arnie with the grenade, hits the T-1000 with it. The grenade explodes. You know, it becomes like a creature from John Carpenter's The Thing at this point. It's all whacked out. The head is on the stalk, and it finally drops into the steel. It takes a while for it to die. We see it morph into like everything that it's become. Every character that it's become, and then finally the last face slowly separates. And it's great because we realize how tough it was to kill this damn thing. So now we have our emotional ending. You know, the T-800 has to join the T-1000 in death in order to keep all of this technology from being, you know, reverse engineered again. So they throw the hand in, they throw the chip in, and there's a nice emotional moment between, you know, like John's like, no, you can't go in. I must, John, I must. So they lower it into the steel, and it gives the thumbs up when it goes under. It's a great ending, you know. You can't help but be affected by it. And then the last shot we get is of a dark highway at night, and Sarah's voiceover that, you know, what's ahead now is unknown. The future is not what we made, so on and so forth. And we are done. So, brief summary of this film. I mean, just, I've said it kind of before, but to sum up, they definitely diverged from the tone of the first film. And there's this whole boy and pet robot sort of through line that goes through this movie that's, I don't love, I got to be honest with you. It works, and I see why it makes this film likable by non-sci-fi fans. Like, it brings it into the kind of the populist realm where you've, like, you get the lines, the Hasta la Vista, you know, you get John playing with his robot, and, you know, people who aren't really hardcore into Terminator or into sci-fi can like the movie and have fun with it as just, like, a kick-ass action movie. So, you know, of course, Cameron, the genius, figured that out. But I don't love it. I definitely don't love it. It's a different animal than the first Terminator, and it definitely sets up what will come in T3, which is, you know, more half comedy, half seriousness. You know, it nods and winks at itself, and it's all the lines that are now repeated from the first film. You know, we're not self-conscious in the first film. I'll be back. Get down. Come with me if you want to live. All this stuff, and, you know, get out. They're all sort of commenting on itself, and it's become a little meta. But Cameron's command of action sequences definitely has upped the first Terminator, because obviously he made two big films after they made Aliens in the Abyss. And he really, you can tell that his feel for the camera, really, he's become a master action director now. And this, it just the film feels just bigger in scope, and how he shoots it just feels like there's a bigger impact to most of it. So it was interesting to see that, watching these now so close together. Linda Hamilton is, like, you know, the core of this film. Her transformation was unbelievable, physical, and even emotional. You know, her acting, while not the greatest, was just incredibly committed, and the conviction that she, you know, gave Sarah was just, you know, amazing. And definitely cements her in as to one of the top female action heroes of all time, frankly. The battles between the two Terminators, there's a ferocity and intensity there that I really love. There's no talking. Brings the film back to kind of a deadly earnestness, which I really like. And yeah, so I'll do a little bit of trivia. This is very interesting, actually. Cameron said in the audio commentary to one version that the biker bar scene was filmed across the street from where LAPD officers beat up Rodney King. And then they were filming the night of the beating. Imagine that. Bizarre coincidence. A female passerby actually wandered into the biker bar set thinking that it was real, despite walking past all the location trucks, the cameras, and the lights. And the woman saw Arnold standing in the bar dressed only in his boxer shorts, wondered what was going on, and Arnold turned around and told her it was male stripper night. Ha ha. It made me think of that play into some of the plot of the early T3. And one last little note, amazingly, with the film's domestic box office adjusted for inflation, it's still the top-grossing R-rated action film of all time. I mean, you know, what other records is Cameron going to break? Thank God, he's like, you know, his movies make so much money, it's unbelievable. So that's all I have to say about T2. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is Patreon. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us again on our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you can search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.